So everything fits perfectly with what we're doing here. After yesterday, some things came up that I was, after our talk yesterday, some things came up. And I had this idea this morning that I have this book that I never look at, that I brought because it had one collection in it that I wanted to look at. And actually then I started looking at another section of the book. It's a collection of classic Buddhist and Zen texts, which is not something that I spend a lot of time on. So I ended up looking last night and this morning at a part of the book that I hadn't intended to look at. And it's a collection of things that were said by Dogen, who, you know, 900 years ago, by Dogen, who was one of the major figures in this Zen lineage, this Zen tradition, as we practice it. And I started reading some of these things he said, and although he said them 900 years ago, they are very pertinent to our lives today. Even though his situation was very different, he was living in Japan, he had practiced in China, he was essentially, for the most part of his life, a monk, and was generally teaching in a monastery context, although often he addressed himself to people who were not monks. So from on the surface, all of that looks like it doesn't apply to me or you. And yet what he says does, because it doesn't have anything to do with being a monk or not, or being in Japan or not, or being in 1233 or in 2012. I started reading these things and realizing that how alive they were. And so I thought, well, maybe I can, at least today, I'm taking one of them, a short little passage, and we'll see what happens with it. I will just read you the short passage, and then we'll go from there. Maybe I should wait until they come in, because that will help them. I don't have it in French, unfortunately. So, for the French speakers, maybe we can try to translate together.
Usually you translate in French.
Sorry?
Usually you translate in French.
Yeah, I can try to. I mean, you know. But with the help of all of us, a collective translation is probably better. But I will wait till they come. It's actually, these are collected sayings from, it's called Record of Things Heard. And it's from his, Dogen's famous Shobo Genzo work, which is, Shobo Genzo is translated as Treasury of the Eye of the True Teaching. Sounds very lofty.
Of the eye
of the true teaching. So it sounds very lofty. Actually, it's not. It's very basic. So I said that I would talk today about a little passage that I read from Dogen, who's one of the major figures in our tradition. And we waited until you arrived to read the passage so that we're all on the same page, more or less. So his Dogen's successor's name was Ajo, and it has him asking this question. So Ajo once asked, in the activity of a patch-robed monk, monks wore rags, basically. They wore a...
guenille.
Yeah, well, they took pieces of cloth and sewed them together to make their clothing. Pieces of cloth that people gave to them, which is what this is supposedly representing. These pat pieces of cloth that we sew together to make this. So, this Ajo says, in the activity of a monk that wears a patched robe, if one mends and patches old and worn out clothing, so mend means to sew, and patch old clothing that's worn out without throwing them away, it seems as if he is greedy in being sparing of things. So he says, it seems like if you have old clothing and you keep patching it up and sewing it, repairing it, and not throwing it away, you're being greedy. How are we translating greedy these days?
Avidité.
Yeah. Yet, if he discards the old, so if he throws away the old clothing and uses the new accordingly, it seems he has a mind which is greedy in seeking that which is new. So it seems like if he throws away the old things and wants new things, he's being greedy by wanting the new things. So, there being fault in either case, so if there's a, looks like that's a problem in either case, a fault, ultimately, how should one deal with this? Ultimately, how should one deal with this? So he's saying if there's a fault in both cases, if you're greedy by repairing the old, and if you're greedy by wanting the new, what do you do? This is kind of like yesterday when we said if we make effort or we don't make effort, or we make too much effort or not enough effort, or, and we can find unlimited situations like this. Every moment we're presented with something like this. Dogen replied, If one just detaches from both greed in sparing and greed in seeking, so you detach from the greed in mending and limiting, keeping things sewn together, and the greed in the seeking, if you detach from both of those, there would be no impropriety in either case. However, he says, of course, there's always a however in Zen, right? Would it not be appropriate to mend what is worn, making it last a long time, and not to covet anything new? So, isn't it appropriate to mend what is worn out? Your shirt has a hole in it, and you mend it, making it last long. Isn't that, that's appropriate, is it not? And isn't it appropriate to not covet something new that you have? How do you say covet in French? It's kind of a biblical term.
Yeah.
No? To...
Covet your neighbor's wife.
Right.
I don't know what the word is in French. C'est
that
un élément d'appropriation, de vouloir s'approprier
convoité.
Quelque chose.
Convoité, c'est ça. Mm. Ouais, convoité in French. So he says, isn't it fine to repair something that's old so that it will last? And isn't it fine to have something new as long as it's we aren't coveting it? Right? So where is the fault in repairing something to make it last longer? And where is the fault in having something new? He's asking his student. So what do we do with that? How do we answer this question in a very concrete way? As I was sitting with this as I would with a koan, and a discussion came back that I had with Lisa just before we came in about the form, the Zen form, and all of that. That we talked about yesterday, in fact, to some extent. And how when I first started out teaching, and I didn't have a group, you know, started out, and I had nothing except 10 mats and 10 cushions. That was it. Nothing. No bells, no incense, no candles, no Buddha, no students, nothing. You know. And we decided that Joa and Delphine, his wife, said, well, you know, why don't we sit at our house? So we did. So we said, okay, we'll just go sit there on Monday nights and we'll see what happens. And it was just the three of us, basically. Sophie came the first night, actually. I had met her like the week before at a conference that I gave. And she came. But for a long time, it was pretty much Joa and Delphine and me. And then occasional people who would come. And then when I would go to Portugal, I didn't have Joa and Delphine, and I didn't have any mats or cushions. And what do? You know? So the question of, do you throw out the old form or do you covet something new? I think I was very much at that time thinking that I had to use the old form, and because I didn't have it, I felt that I was lacking something. I didn't know how to proceed. I didn't have anyone else who knew any of the form in Portugal, for example. And so it was very painful and difficult. And there was a point at which I thought I would quit everything and not teach, or not like this, actually. And that was probably a very important point when I said, not this. Not like this. Because that allowed me then to start from zero, to start over. And then look at, okay, what is new and what is old and what do I keep from the old and what do I look for new? And when I look for something new, not to cling to it either. So, for example, you know, we come here and we do something. Okay, we change how we do Orioke. In the beginning, in our group, we didn't even do Orioke. Some of you will remember that. We did an improvised Orioke where we sat at the... We didn't have any bowls. We didn't have any of this equipment. So we sat at the table together. Sometimes we served each other like this. Sometimes we had someone serving us just on a plate. And then a gift arrived. Someone gave us 10 sets of orioki. So we decided to do orioki. We didn't cling to our idea of we have to keep that old way of sitting around the table. That was our new way that we have to keep. That was our new old way we have to keep. Okay, circumstances changed, and we started doing orioki. This time the group is smaller, although I think the group is the same size as it was last year. And we decided to sit in a circle and do it. Okay, we don't cling to the old way, we do something else. So how do we know then when to keep the old and when to try something new and when to repair what's broken and when to replace it? How do we know? Where is that point? Dogen isn't really answering that to his student's question. He is answering it, but he's not answering it to the satisfaction, probably, of the student's initial question. Ultimately, the question is, how do we respond to this moment, right? So, whatever arises will be new. How do we respond to that? How do we... Sometimes we need to repair the old robe. Sometimes we need a new robe. So Lisa was asking me, did I... if I chose to do it this way, if I chose to start over with the forms and throw things away and bring things back and create new things and whatever. And I said I didn't really, although maybe because I didn't come to this practice because I was attracted to the forms, I had less attachment to them, maybe. Although I did the whole thing, you know, for all the years I practiced with my teacher, and I did the whole thing, and like everybody else. The change arose organically, as it always does. The situation made it necessary to do something else. I knew that wherever we decided to sit was the zendo. It could be outside, it could be inside. It could be a room like this. It could be my living room. It could be Joa's house. It could be, we sat in an office, Sophie's brother-in-law in his office. It could be anywhere. And yet, how do we make that the zendo? What makes it the zendo? An experience that I tell often is sitting in an abandoned schoolyard in New York, in a bad neighborhood, with Bernie Glassman and his group. Sitting there on, you know, old boxes, a log, a rock, and the altar was a stone, a piece of wood that we put there, and a beer can that was on the ground. That was the altar. And we sat. Sometimes that's appropriate. Other times, there's no reason that we would need to put a beer can on that altar here, right? We could, but there's no reason. We have this Buddha and we use it. In the interview room, we didn't have a Buddha. So I said to Rita, find something else. Go out in the forest, in the road, whatever. Find something else. And she did. And in order to see it, you have to come to interview. I can tell you what it means.
The thing we can interview.
You don't have to.
It's still there.
It's still there, absolutely. It's a beautiful stone. Beautiful. It's a beautiful stone. Yeah.
It's special.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, if for some reason someone tripped and the table fell over and the Buddha was broken, I don't wish that upon. It's Joa's Buddha that he's traveled around the world with, and I don't think he wants it broken, but if it did happen, we could repair it and put it back. And is there something wrong with that? Is there a fault in repairing what's broken and putting it back? Or should we then say, oh, it's broken, let's get rid of it, let's put a stone there. Let's get something new. Maybe. Maybe it would be beyond repair. Maybe not. And it's coming to my mind, this business of repairing. When I arrived in Portugal a few weeks ago for the retreat, I had a piece of clothing, a linen blouse, that I wear in the summertime, which I like very much, which I covet. And it's perfect for Portugal, where it's very hot, and yet it covers, so that I have sensitive skin, so it could burn. And when I took it out of my bag, it was torn. A big tear on the sleeve. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll try to sew it. So I asked the people in the meeting, at the SAMU meeting, if anyone had a needle and thread to sew. And someone did. And then she added, but I love to sew and I'm available to sew. I said, wonderful, great, I'll give it to you and you can sew. Do it, because I'm not really very good at sewing. So I gave it to her, and the next day she gave it back to me, beautifully, repaired beautifully. And she said she had done it in such a way so that it's white, and the thread she had was, you know, more like this color. But so she had done it, and she said, it looks just like a flower that's here. And she took me to show me the flower in the field. And she was very pleased, and I was very pleased, and she said, but you know, look here, and she lifted up the arm, and she said, it's wearing out here, too. You know? She said, it tore here because it's worn out. It's linen, and it's very delicate, and it's wearing out. And at that moment, I had to admit that the end was near for this garment, right? That it was fine to repair it, but that this was probably its final summer. Unless I wanted to keep repairing every tear. And so at once, there is something Well, you know, it's like someone recently told me his dog died. He was 13 years old, his dog, and he loved his dog. And he said that her loss has left an enormous vide in my life. And also, having experienced those 13 years with her was a priceless experience. The richness of that experience, of sharing that, those 13 years with her, was priceless. So at once he was appreciating the depth of the loss and the richness that that loss helped him to experience, in fact, to realize, in fact. The richness of the depth of the loss showed him the depth of the richness that had been shared with his dog, right? And I probably could say the same thing about my shirt. Or can we say that about any moment? Can we say that about everything that arises? It's going, impermanent. It's so gone so fast we can't even hold it. Can't even for a second. And fully experiencing that, the depth of that loss, we fully experience the fullness of the beauty and the wonder of that moment, whatever it is. I can fully appreciate that this shirt that I've worn all these years. I had forgotten even that it was old. I had forgotten how long I've... And it's had quite an existence. I once forgot it in a hotel room and came back a week later and it was still there. They kept it for me. You know, it served me well. So I guess, in fact, greed, how would you then say, what is greed? Avidité.
Well, to want something and not be able to, or at the same time not willing to let go. That's greed, maybe. Mm. I mean, wanting very much and wanted to keep it without the intention of letting go. Mm. So if you can be greedy and enjoy it, but at the same time you have to be willing to see that it's transforming all the time, and that you have that it's impossible not to let go, maybe.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's
and maybe it's about acceptance to let go.
Yeah.
Also guilt, the guilt. I mean, it's also a bit about guilt. I mean, you're greedy if you want to keep the old, and you're greedy if you want to have the new. I mean, there's always kind of... I mean, for me...
Well, that's why he says, yeah, there seems to be a fault in both.
Yes, I mean...
And Dogen is saying, well, there's not really a fault in either one.
No, so guilt you can drop immediately. Mm. But then it still work.
Of course. Of course. Yeah.
Well, there's work in anything.
That's life.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I think it's this impossibility to be able to let go, which prevents me to enjoy the moment, the instant, what is at this moment.
Yeah, we miss it.
Could it be a resistance to learn if you hold on the old, you doesn't want new, but you cannot let go of the old. Maybe a resistance to learn. Because it is a little pain if you let go.
Or is it a resistance to pain?
Maybe they're the same. As the saying goes, pain is unavoidable, suffering is optional. So
can you explain that? Can you say again what can you say what with this sentence that I didn't understand?
Okay. I don't know if I can resume what they said. I forgot. It's passed already.
But it's the resistance to let go is the resistance to learn, to learn, or to have pain.
Or to have pain.
Resistance also to know the new.
To something new. There is a resistance to hold on.
And resistance to have pain. To have something new.
And then you said there's a resistance. I mean, you can have pain, but that's not the same as suffering.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I did not understand that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's pain and there's suffering. So you make a...
So we say pain is unavoidable.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Inevitable.
Unavoidable.
Inevitable.
Yeah. Inevitable.
It's in everything all the time.
La douleur est inévitable, mais pas la souffrance.
Mais la souffrance est facultatif. Isn't it?
Yes.
The example I always give is childbirth. Christine knows this one very well. Third time around. Where it's very painful. Physically, the pain of childbirth, it's real. You know, your body is doing something that is painful. It's painful. Just the nature of it is painful, right? Sorry, what?
Not necessarily.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying. Not necessarily. Absolutely. That's what that sentence means. There is this pain. The muscles are doing something that they don't usually do. The body has to open in a way that it doesn't normally open. Maybe if we gave birth every day, it would be different. But we don't. So the body is doing something that's unusual, according to its usual habits, whatever. When I was going through this, my teacher was sitting there and she looked at me and she said, go in the same direction as the pain. I forget how she said it in French. I'm sure she said it in French, but... aller dans le même sens que la douleur. Something like that. And she said this to me like between contractions, so there was a moment of lucidity, so I could hear it. And immediately, boom, I got it. And I think because the situation was so extreme that I got it. And I put that into action simply by not resisting the pain.
So you mean suffering is resisting?
Exactly. That's how suffering arises.
Okay. Resisting. And pain is pain. Sadness, pain.
Can be anything. Yeah. Okay. But resisting that is what causes suffering.
Yes.
And that applies to any circumstance. Uh, We say that, you know, when the Buddha said life is suffering, he meant that we suffer because we try to resist the impermanence, right? We try to stay young. We don't want to be unhealthy. We don't want to be sick. We don't want.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what causes our suffering, rather than just going in this set direction of whatever is arising.
So whatever is arising is pain, is jealousy, is anger, is hate, everything.
Is love, is joy, is beauty, yeah. Is whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it doesn't mean that we like hate, or that we like jealousy, or that we like whatever it is. It just means that we don't resist it. Now, how does that
translate?
How do we work that?
Yes.
How do we do that?
Let's just hate everybody.
No.
Yeah, but you know, for example, in war situations, mm-hmm. I mean, somebody killed your father very cruelly. So, how do you do that?
Mm. That's a good question. I've never been in that situation, so I don't know.
No, but you know,
absolutely.
That's really a big question.
Yeah, absolutely. And these are big questions. And when we look at someone, you know, like the Dalai Lama, so this is the extreme, you know, the Dalai Lama, with his country that's being, you know, depending on which side you're on, being transformed. You know, I think from the Chinese side, they think they're doing something positive, and from the Tibetan side, they consider it being negative. In any case, there's a deep change going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And the Dalai Lama's approach is not to go and fight fire with fire.
Mm-hmm.
His approach is, okay, let's talk about this. Let's compromise. Let's, you know, peacefully. For the moment, it looks like it's not working. But when we're talking about this kind of approach, there is no time and space. So, the notion of it working or not, according to the time and space, dualistic ways of thinking, doesn't apply. Because he's not functioning in that way, the Dalai Lama. You know, it's kind of like when we're eating Oreoki, and I'm finished eating, and everyone else is too, but maybe Lisa's not. From one aspect, it looks like everyone is finished eating and Lisa's not. But the truth is that none of us, we haven't finished eating, because she's still eating. From a time and space aspect, it looks like she's still eating and I'm finished. But when we look at it from the level of no time and space, of one body, we haven't finished eating. And in fact, we never finish eating. Okay, that meal is complete, but someone else is eating somewhere else. And we're all starving too, because there are people who don't have food, and that's us too. Right? I'm giving really extreme examples because it's easier when there's less nuance to explain. On an experiential level, it's easier. It doesn't matter so much, the nuance, on an experiential level. But when we try to using words as conceptual, and when we approach it conceptually, it's better to use bold strokes, non-nuanced situations. So everyone is looking a bit perplexed here.
No, you know, because it's the question how to learn not to resist, you know, things we all can understand, like jealousy and hate and mourning, etc., etc. But if situations are impossible, like I told you, somebody killed your father, very cruel, or something else. I mean, not talking about myself. But of course, everybody knows impossible situations, which is extremely difficult because you sometimes have to deal with karma, which means things you cannot control, but they are part of you. I mean, when you are born in Bosnia, it's part of you.
Absolutely.
And how do you deal with a situation? Some situations are impossible. Impossible.
How do you define impossible?
Let's say if there's a person beside you who is really cruel to your child, for example. I'm giving extreme mm-hmm. examples, but I think everybody's life knows extreme mm-hmm. things. So how do you deal with it? There's it's the same as this clothing story. There's guilt if you do not connect, and there's guilt if you connect. I mean, there's it's difficult to
what do you mean by connect?
There's guilt if you want to do something about the situation because you cannot, and if you are angry, there will be more anger or whatever. And if you do nothing, you are guilty also. It's like, you know, this...
It's a no-win situation, you say.
Some situations. I mean, when you are a Jew in war, I mean, there are no-win situations.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So...
That's why the answer is elsewhere. It's not in the right, wrong,
yeah. No.
Do not do.
It's, no,
it's,
so
it's elsewhere.
It's some things are too much to feel the pain. How, I mean...
We think that's true. We do, we think that it's too much.
But if you go into this huge complex thing of fear, hatred, anger, etc., etc., you end in compassion?
Mm-hmm.
Always?
Let's say that if the natural functioning of wisdom is compassion. And that's the traditional way of saying it.
Mm.
Wisdom meaning just seeing the oneness, experiencing the oneness of things, so the non-separation.
Okay.
And therefore, naturally what arises is compassion, because it's not there's not two.
Okay.
So
you, it's only about accepting everything, including
mm-hmm.
everything.
Mm-hmm. That's right. But what does that mean, accepting? Yes, Brigitte is impatient to say something. No. No,
no, I am just thinking about the
the Dutch woman.
Dutch woman.
Yeah.
Who was in the camp,
yes.
Really exactly what you said.
Yes.
And she was in the middle of this horrible thing. Mm-hmm. Her mother died. Mm-hmm. Her sister, I think, also.
Well, yeah. Well, she volunteered to come, but
yeah, she didn't have to go.
She didn't have to go. She volunteered.
Yeah. Yeah. And she, yes, of course. Mm-hmm. Plus, and she was just in the middle of that and doing what she could do,
mm-hmm.
helping people or as. Is it working or not? I mean, in a macro system, it's not working because it doesn't change. It didn't
anything.
Change anything. But around her, the lot of people she helped in the camp, yes, it's, I think, it changed a lot.
It reminds me also of a book I recently read, Nonviolent Communication. Did you
Yes.
Mm. Because what he essentially does is, if he goes into conflictual situations, is bring people to speak about their experience, their pain, or their, what they feel, and makes it easier then for the other part to connect, because we all share these emotions, mm. these the same, our human nature, and when people stop accusing and only speak about what they think, but what they feel if somebody acts like this. And
so you disconnected from the accusing, but you just say how you feel.
Yes.
Your feeling might be that you're feeling like you want to accuse.
Yeah. But you can say
yeah,
that.
But yeah, but it's different if you say it like this.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yeah.
Or yeah, if you accuse.
Okay, interesting.
It's a very nice book. There are lots of examples in it where, yeah, you start from a situation where there is only conflict, and then if you apply this kind of speaking, in the end,
yeah,
everyone sees that we are connected and
beautiful.
You know, because if you come from a position of, this is where greed comes in too, if you come from a position of, I know, right?
Mm-hmm.
I know what's right, I know what's wrong, I'm clinging to that,
yeah,
right and wrong.
Yeah, then the other one is wrong.
Exactly. And that's very greedy to hang on to,
yeah,
my position, right?
Yeah.
However, if we approach it from a position of not knowing, I don't know. I don't know what will arise. I don't know what the situation presents. I let go of my ideas, my opinions about the situation, and just, you know, as Bernie Glassman says, bear witness. Just be present with whatever it is. So in this case, yes, if you, it's a conflictual situation, you come to the table and you say, okay, I put aside my opinions. I have them, but I will put them aside. I won't hang on to them. I may be in the situation I'm asked to give my opinion, but my opinion is not the only one, right? Then I am thus, then I'm available, I'm disponible, which is the ultimate position. I'm disponible, I'm open, I'm available to whatever arises. So then the other person gives their opinion, and I can just be available to it. It doesn't mean I have to agree, but I'm available to it.
Hmm.
I hear it. I acknowledge it, whatever that is. And then the positioning for conflict is very different, because there's not two ideas conflicting with one another. There's just two positions that are there. And they're not necessarily conflictual. And surprisingly enough, if one is not attached to his position, the other is less likely to be attached to his position as well.
Yeah, it's interesting, realizes, because if you start accusing, you make yourself a victim, and the mm-hmm. other sees himself as a how do you call it,
perpetrator.
Yeah. So it's very difficult to not step into that.
And it just goes one step.
Yes, that's cause, yeah, and cause and effect. I mean, mm-hmm. you're creating mm-hmm. karma.
Exactly, mm-hmm. that's what karma is.
Yes,
exactly.
So to neutralize karma, or to I mean, can you work on karma to make it a little less?
Mm-hmm. To be one with it is what we say.
One, yeah.
And therefore create less waves. And
yeah,
something else is happening.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily negative in the sense of harmful.
Yeah.
So Of course, we can't control what the results of our actions. You know, we don't know what the result of our sitting here right now is. There might be something harmful arising from this. We don't know. You know, maybe because I'm not at home, my son is lonely, or I don't know. You know, who knows? And is that harmful if my son is lonely? I really don't think my son is lonely because I'm not at home. It just came to mind. Is that harmful? If he's lonely? Maybe that's an important experience for him. I don't know. So we can't control any of it. The whole thing is chaos. There's nothing but chaos, actually.
Yeah.
The world is chaotic.
And guilt is an idea that we can control anything. I mean, that's if we have guilt feelings.
I'm responsible.
That's in fact the attachment to having control,
mm-hmm. to someone.
Yeah,
who
because
controls.
I'm guilty.
Yeah. Yeah. Guilt is a big
control
fruit of the
thing. Yeah.
The I who controls.
Yeah.
Who's in charge?
Mm-mm.
Exactly. How are we for time?
It's 1:00.
Okay. Anyone have anything else?
I was just thinking about examples of when people have used something like this non-violent dialogue, like in South Africa after the end of apartheid, when they had the Truth and Reconciliation, which probably avoided a bloodbath in South Africa, I'm not saying the situation in South Africa is wonderful at the moment, but I think that process helped a lot of people to let things go, which would otherwise have festered and made a difficult situation worse. And it's greed now and people hanging on to resentments that are creating a lot of the problems. Mm-hmm. There and elsewhere in the world, and not just there, but I was just thinking of it in particular because they had that Truth and Reconciliation, which was such an amazing process to be introduced, and the effect that it had on the perpetrators. Some of these people who were confronted with the people whom they had, whose husbands or sons they had killed, they were confronted with them in these kind of hearings. They weren't really courts, hearings. Mm-hmm. And these people, as you said, they saw another human being rather than an enemy, mm-hmm. and saw the harm that their action, and it may have been an action that they had been ordered to do because they were policemen or in the army or whatever, but they saw it as a human being that, even though they could hide behind it, I was only acting under orders. They were confronted with the humanness of the people whom they had hurt, mm. or whom they had deprived of a family member.
Tu peux dire en français quel est le process? Vous pouvez les conséquences, mais j'ai pas compris le process en lui-même, la méthode.
Mais c'était en Afrique du Sud, quand mm. après la fin de l'apartheid, ils ont eu un processus de, c'était, je ne sais pas comment ça s'appelle en français, c'est vérité et réconciliation. Et il y avait c'était pas des cours pour juger les gens, mais c'était des gens qui ont fait le tour de tout le pays. Et les gens qui avaient perdu les membres de leur famille, leur fils, leur mari, souvent devant leurs yeux, avaient la possibilité d'en parler devant les gens qui avaient commis ces actes. Souvent, ces gens qui avaient commis ces actes. Et c'était très fort, parce que le but n'était pas de punir ces gens, mais souvent, les gens étaient après poursuivis par la justice, par ce qui était établi dans ces... Mais ce n'était pas le but de ces réunions. C'était presque des réunions. Mais c'était très fort, parce que, comme a dit Émile et Christine, c'était non conflictuel. C'était devant la vérité de ce qui s'était passé. Donc pour la personne qui avait perdu quelqu'un ou qui avait un vieil homme, par exemple, qui avait été tellement blessé qu'il était plus du tout valide, qui était confronté avec les personnes, la personne qui avait fait ça, mais pas en l'accusant, en disant voilà ce qui m'est arrivé. Et c'était très fort pour les gens qui avaient souffert de pouvoir, je ne vais pas, j'ai dit pouvoir, non, enfin de pouvoir, c'était le mot que j'allais utiliser, d'avoir le pouvoir, de reprendre leur propre pouvoir, de dire voilà ce qui m'est arrivé. Et je ne vais pas dire pouvoir dans le mauvais sens, d'avoir pouvoir sur quelqu'un d'autre, mais...
Possibilité.
Mais oui, non, mais même un sens de ne pas être victime, de passer...
Se réapproprier.
De se réapproprier.
Et ça avait un effet positif sur la personne, la victime, mais aussi peut-être indirectement sur l'autre.
Et aussi sur l'autre, c'est ce que j'avais dit, sur l'autre aussi, parce que l'autre était confronté pas à un être humain, et pas un ennemi, pas quelqu'un qui fallait à tout prix écarter parce qu'il allait l'empêcher de vivre comme il avait dû toujours vécu, etc.
Les deux se découvraient comme être humains.
Voilà. Ouais. Et ça n'a pas résolu, comme j'ai dit au début, ça n'a pas résolu tous les problèmes, mais je suis sûre que ça a évité, ça en a évité beaucoup en Afrique du Sud.
Comme dit Brigitte, c'est au niveau, pour chacun en tout cas, ça n'a pas fait quelque chose de général, mais pour chacun, ça fait des îlots de,
voilà,
un peu de réparation, de guérison.
Oui.
And we can really look at almost any conflict on the global scene, or but in individual lives, and apply the same ideas. You look at, in France we have this problem of, just recently there were the riots in the suburb in a community of immigrants, which is repetitive, happens all the time, over and over and over, and it's happening again and again. And, you know, if you approach that from a position of, these are horrible kids who are, destroying public property and attacking the police and not respecting the values of the French Republic and all the kind of discourse that we hear, then of course there's endless conflict. And the police are bad because they're attacking the kids, and the kids are bad because they're attacking the police, and no one's respecting each other, and terrible crime, destruction, violence, whatever. But if you approach a situation like that as saying, okay, these kids for the most part have been rejected from mainstream society. They live in a hopeless situation. Their schools are bad. Huge level of unemployment. So uneducated, unemployed, no hope of any change possible in their lives. And I'm just touching really on the surface of the situation. And the police, who are frustrated, not recognized either completely, or recognized only as being enforcers or violent people, who don't have the means to deal effectively with this kind of community, who only are given guns and limited training, are not taught to how to communicate properly in a non-violent manner, the whole thing is just impossible then. But if we approach it from a non-violent communication way, which involves not knowing, bearing witness, loving action, speaking from the heart, listening from the heart, the kind of practices that we do here, something else will happen. We don't know what, but something else will arise. You know, it's like we say, if you plant, if we use our resources to create nuclear bombs, well then, there will be one result. If we use our resources to create something else, there will be another result. You know? We're capable of doing many things. We have the resources and we have the potential to do many things. What do we choose? And the values of our culture are such that we choose destructive things. But it doesn't have to be that way.
And Bertolt Brecht says, we speak about the violence of the river, but we didn't speak about the violence of the berge qui l'encerre, les berges, you know, the
banks,
the edge banks, who contain press it.
And that's a good example because they're functioning together absolutely perfectly. The banks and the river are functioning perfectly together, and the violence, as we would say, you know, the force of the river is a result of that, the banks. And it's, in fact, it's neither good nor bad. It's just what arises. Given those circumstances, that's what arises. It's neither good nor bad. I'd say the same thing about everything. However, when we open that argument of war being neither good nor bad, something else. You know, that triggers a lot of questions, more questions.
And we can say without rivers there is no banks, and without banks there
That's
is
right.
no river.
That's right. That's right, absolutely. The river just becomes a flaque d'eau, you know, more or less, a puddle. Without the banks. And the banks without the river are not banks, they're just a piece of land.
It reminds me the structure and the no structure you spoke about yesterday.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. That's why this touches upon it. In fact, that's why this text came to mind. So, what time is it now?
Quarter past.
Can I just say one thing? Mm-hmm. One man in South Africa made a huge difference, and that was Mandela.
We know that, yeah.
Absolutely. And this, the Truth and Reconciliation was grâce à lui.
Absolutely.
So
one man does make a difference.
Can make a difference.
Yeah.
Can make a difference.
Absolutely.
And he was nonviolent throughout, spent years and decades in prison, made friends with his jailer.
Yeah. And I think the same thing is true of the Dalai Lama. We don't see it in the same way that he's making a difference, but it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's...
Perhaps it's not one person. It's one person, more lots person who are ready. But
it takes one.
It has said
His influence then. But he stood up. He didn't know whether he was good. He stood up from a very young age and said, "No, this cannot be."
Mm-hmm.
and carried the whole thing through and didn't react with hatred when he had won. Soi-disant.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we are each that one person. Mm. We are each that one man.
Yeah.
Every single one of us.
Yeah.
And what can we step up and live that way?
Mm.
Moment to moment. As Mandela, it's moment to moment. It's not, you know.
No, still moment to moment.
Absolutely. And the Dalai Lama too. Mm-hmm. You know, the Tibetans had this saying that they used to say, the Dharma, the teachings, will go west when the iron bird flies. It's this traditional thing, saying.
Can you repeat it?
That the Dharma, the Buddhist teachings,
uh-huh,
would go west,
mm-hmm,
when the iron bird flies.
Iron fair.
It's like a...
Iron.
Yeah, iron. No, it's a metal.
Iron bird.
Yeah. So when the iron bird flies, the teachings will go west. And so now that is being seen as being a prophecy that in fact happened, that airplanes are the iron bird, and the teachings have gone west. Well, why have they gone west? Because the Dalai Lama was forced to leave Tibet. If the Dalai Lama had not been forced to leave Tibet, Tibet would still be a closed kingdom, very isolated. No one, hardly anyone, would hear about Tibetan Buddhism. It would be still this kind of feudal kingdom up in the Himalayas where very few people went, and a few travelers would go, but nothing would not have at all the reach that it has now, with all of these lamas in the West and setting up communities, and everybody knows who the Dalai Lama is, almost, you know. Whereas before 1959, it was kind of this, you know, mythic figure in Shangri-La, living up in the mountains somewhere.
To the point where it's completely absurd when you talk about Buddhism, that's the first thing that comes to mind to people. Yeah. Where it's,
absolutely.
It's
a very small sect.
Small.
Yeah. In the,
What I have read of Mandela, when he was in jail, he was desperate, because he couldn't do anything. And on the moment that he saw a very, very small flower was growing between rocks, while he was walking in the yard.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was not a yard, but it was, and then suddenly, in his mind, he wrote, said, no, I am fighting against the regime. No, it's not good. I have to understand what they think. And so I have to go with the flow. And then he could speak with the leaders. It was difficult, but he could speak with the leaders. And before that, before the shift, he was against, no. And so at that time, he was enlightened.
Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that hearing about the flower growing through the thing, that's exactly why I called this group Wildflower Sangha. Wildflowers grow everywhere, in every circumstance, between the walls of a prison, on a sidewalk, in the forest, in the city, in the mountains, in the valleys, in the desert, everywhere.
Right. And you try to get rid of it, it comes back.
It comes back.
On the road.
Absolutely. Everywhere.